Welcome back to TechNet Radio. It's IT time, and in today's episode, Blaine Barton welcomes fellow IT pro evangelist Bob Hunt and principal program manager Ross Smith to the show as they discuss Exchange 2010 storage. Tune in as they tackle many of the topics that companies find challenging concerning remote storage, from how to optimize it and high availability to cost-saving best practice solutions. Blaine, the mic is yours.
Hello and welcome to IT Time. I'm Blaine Barton, your senior IT pro evangelist with Microsoft. And with me today, I have two special guests. I have Mr. Bob Hunt. How are you doing, Bob?
Doing very well. How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks. And we also have Ross Smith. How are you doing, Ross?
Good. How are you?
Great. Doing great. Welcome, guys. A little bit about you. Bob Hunt is also a senior IT pro evangelist with Microsoft. He's out of the New York Metro. He also has, you know, supporting various communities such as in New Jersey, Fairfield County, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. Bob Hunt is a peer and friend of mine. He's got, you know, over 20 years of IT experience. So Bob's been on all three sides of the industry, being in consulting and then on an IT staff prior to his 6 years here at Microsoft. Before joining the developer and platform evangelism team in 2010, Bob was the guru around Exchange and specifically unified communications as a technology specialist in Microsoft's New York Metro EPG district, where he was working with largest, most world-famous email environments. And he hosted the, and still is involved with the New York Exchange user group for over 5 years. So welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Blaine. Happy to be here.
You betcha. We also have Mr. Ross Smith, who's also a principal program manager and a member of the customer experience team. How are you doing, Ross?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. Looks like you're involved in critical customer escalations and assisted, you know, defining improvements and implementations and running Exchange, you know, next generation engineering experiences and processes. So heavy hitter on the Exchange side. I'm excited about today. We bring Bob and Ross together to talk about Exchange 2010 storage. So before we kick that off, I'd like to maybe move over to Bob and ask him, I'm interested in how you really got first started in computers.
Well, it's one of those things where it's family ties have a lot to do with it. Or my dad was an IBMer for like 35 years, so seeing his involvement with that led me to take a class at a local library, and I just fell in love. I think I was 8, so it was about it was about 15 years ago. Seriously though, it was something that interested me early on in life, and happy to be able to do some amazing things like the kind of impact that working for Microsoft has. So very happy to be spending my time in my career here.
Absolutely. How about you, Ross? How did you get started in computers? What was your first computer experience?
My first computer experience was as an intern at an Army organization where I had to develop several websites for them. That was it. And then from there, it just moved into IT work and then into designing systems and then finally into product development.
Nice. So back to Bob, a real quick question for you. What are you going to cover today as far as Exchange storage? Can you give us a kind of enlighten us here on what we're going to talk about today?
Absolutely. So for those of you who are, at least have some familiarity with Exchange, understanding the amounts and volume of email that most companies have to deal with, there's generally lots of things that go along with the storage aspect of that email. Some of which is just the sheer volume of it, and then it's essentially the cost of it. And then people tend to forget that generally the number one cost for managing email environments is actually the storage of it. So it's very important that you're smart about it from a cost perspective, but also from a high availability perspective. You want to make sure that that email environment that you have is up and running. It's there all the time. And certainly, from a storage perspective, many of us have been through the place of, oh, geez, I filled up my email box. You want to make sure you have enough of that storage, right? So being able to have that storage, you know, always available to you, but having enough of it is the gist of what I know Ross spends a lot of time talking with customers about, doing it inexpensively with some of the things that are available in the latest version of Exchange is what we're going to focus on today.
Great, great. So, Ross, what do you want to add to today's discussion around what are the biggest challenges around Exchange 2010 storage?
So I think one of the biggest challenges in terms of storage is that for years, customers have deployed storage in such a way to meet the I/O requirements of Exchange back in the 2000-2003 versions, where we were very I/O demanding, and that drove customers into deploying high performing disks, which invariably moved them toward storage area network type of infrastructure to meet the sheer number of disks for those I/O requirements. And we've, over the last two releases, in the 2007 and 2010 release, we've done a lot of work to reduce our I/O so that we can move ourselves back into a model where we can be both efficient in terms of I/O and capacity capabilities, getting us back into a means where we can balance those two out and effectively utilize storage from both areas, which can help drive down storage costs, as you won't be overspending or overutilizing disks in one fashion and underutilizing them in another.
Are you still spending a lot of time, Ross, educating folks, essentially convincing them that, that the product is ready for some of those technological changes that we've made in the Exchange product? Or do you think most of the customers have moved past that into actually designing or deploying the storage recommendations that we've got for the later version of Exchange?
I think in it's a little of both. In many cases, it is still trying to help our customers understand what product changes we've made into the product, so that when we say that moving from Exchange 2003 to Exchange 2010, and when we talk about a 91% reduction in I/O when an equivalent mailbox from the 2003 platform is moved to the 2010 platform, is not a marketing gimmick. And we drive into the details of how we change the extensible storage engine and the underlying database store. It helps them understand where we're coming from in terms of why these I/O changes did occur, and helps reinforce the message naturally that, yes, we can actually effectively utilize 7200 RPM disks and get you to a point where you could leverage large mailboxes without having to have a vast number of disks behind that infrastructure.
So what are the things that you typically have customers go through to test out and make sure that this new storage infrastructure is going to make, or should say, meet the requirements for their business? What are the tools that we have to make that happen?
Yes. So first and foremost, to be able to properly design a storage platform, you have to understand the message profile. The message profile is simply the number of messages sent or received per day, tied with an average message size. Couple that with the number of users you're deploying on, you can effectively design, you can obtain the I/O profile that you need to target towards when designing a storage platform. So you could leverage, if you're coming from Exchange 2003 or Exchange 2007, you can leverage the Exchange Profile Analyzer to obtain that data. If you're already on Exchange 2010 and you want to redesign and take advantage of some of the optimizations, my good friend Neil Johnson over in the UK MCS has developed a script that gives you the message stats, or you could use a third-party solution to obtain that type of data. In many ways, it's looking at the message tracking logs, looking at the transport protocol logs, and obtaining a good view of what your user population is doing during the day. Once you obtain this I/O profile, then you can utilize a tool like the Mailbox Server Role Requirements Calculator to help you determine the amount of I/O and the amount of capacity you need for a disk subsystem. Or you can calculate these things manually by running through the steps that are documented in our core documentation on TechNet. With the I/O and capacity data, you can then start determining what kind of storage subsystem you want to deploy. Once you obtain that storage subsystem and you think you've architected it to meet the host I/O and capacity, specifically the host I/O, you can then use our tool JetStress to evaluate that storage subsystem and ensure that it can actually sustain that I/O profile, which is critical when you deploy the storage subsystem and have your users operating at peak load.
So is it suffice to say that this JetStress application becomes more of a judge and jury in terms of what the performance of this storage subsystem is going to look like when you actually put your exchange production environment on this storage?
Yes, in a way. It's only as good as the data you enter into the JetStress tool, naturally. So if you have your message profile wrong, you have your user population wrong, or your target I/O profile incorrect, then the data is somewhat irrelevant at that point. But making the assumption that you know what you're targeting toward and the storage system meets or exceeds that target I/O profile, then you are reasonably assured that you will be able to achieve that load in production. Now, that does assume that the way you built out that storage subsystem for that JetStress test is exactly the same as how you deploy it in production. So if you make architectural changes, you should reevaluate it by testing it again on JetStress prior to a production deployment and migrating mailboxes to 2010.
Okay, so all right, so that's very interesting. So this also tells me that, say, for example, I'm evaluating storage for my exchange organization, and maybe I've got some expensive storage that I want to, continue to utilize, and maybe I want to look at, some of this less expensive storage that Microsoft is telling me that I can use for my exchange environment. I have the ability now, once I have my I/O profile and I understand what my requirements are from a storage standpoint and I/O standpoint, is I can essentially put one storage architecture up against another and really lab out whether or not it's going to meet the requirements for my business before I buy even, correct?
Most definitely.
Okay, that's great. So what are some of the other things? Now, one of the things that I know we talked about previously was from a storage standpoint, it's great to get the right storage for your organization. But tell me some of the things that you're talking to customers regularly about, keeping that highly available, having multiple copies of it, and things like that. What are the things that you're spending a lot of time talking to customers about these days in the areas of high availability and storage?
So in many ways, the predominant point that I'm trying to get across when talking about designing Exchange 2010 is to take a look at your requirements and drive toward meeting those requirements while simplifying your environment. Reduce the complexity in the environment in any ways you can. Storage is complex. Archiving can be complex. High availability and site resilience can be complex. So looking at ways you can reduce those, leveraging native features within the application is a great way to reduce complexity. Instead of leveraging, for example, a third-party solution for data replication to obtain site resilience, utilize the built-in features that we have in Exchange 2010 with continuous replication and have multiple database copies. It is interesting. We have we just recently posted to the eHello blog, the MS Exchange team blog, an article, another one of my good friends, Boris Lukovitsky, wrote about around basically the theory of probability and how the probability of failures affects availability and how you can mitigate those failures. For example, we looked at it from a simple approach of having four database copies, and each database copy being on a single disk, a JBOD case in that scenario. And looking at it, leveraging a 7200 RPM SATA disk, the industry has reported numerous times that the annualized failure rate for a 7200 RPM SATA disk is around 5%. So you can look at it from the perspective that you have a 1 in 20th chance, a 20% chance that one out of four disks will fail. So when you look at it from that perspective, just having a single copy, you know, your availability is greatly affected just with a single copy. If you add a second copy, then, you know, it becomes a 1 in 400 chance. If you add a third copy, it's a 1 in 8,000 chance, and so forth. So as you add more copies, the likelihood of failure of this particular database is greatly reduced now because we have multiple copies in the infrastructure. And that means that your availability increases by a factor of 20 for each copy that you add. So it's a great way to look at it and kind of view how adding additional copies, how changing some of the storage slots can improve your environment. You also have to look at it from an operational standpoint as well. Making some changes in one area can increase the operational complexities in others. So you do have to take the appropriate steps to improve operational processes to adjust for those type of architectural changes.
Now, that's very interesting. And let me jump back to one of the points that I think you made there before. So you're essentially saying that we're recommending now, or I know we're recommending now, essentially using a single disk as essentially a database or a LUN for the for the storage of an Exchange database. And you're saying now when you add another copy, it's just adding another disk. It's just adding another a SATA drive. Is what it sounds like you're recommending okay, great. I've got this, low cost hardware, and there's a percentage of those that are going to fail, 5%, whatever. But if I've got multiple copies of this, okay, it's an inexpensive disk, but backing it up and having a second version or third version of that same database is still a relatively inexpensive thing for me to protect my business, correct?
Yes, but there were a few things there. I want to touch upon. So the first is that we aren't necessarily recommending the JBOD approach. It's now an option for deployment with Exchange 2010. Our basic guidelines for recommending JBOD, and I guess I should define what JBOD is because everyone has a different view of what JBOD means. JBOD stands for just a bunch of disks. In the Exchange world, JBOD simply means having your Exchange database, your transaction logs, and the content indexed all on a single physical disk. And that physical disk is not rated. It's not RAID 0, it's not RAID 10, it's not RAID 5, it's not RAID 1, etc. There's just no RAID. It's a simple disk that is provisioned and formatted at the host application layer. And so this JBOD concept becomes an option when you have a minimum of at least three highly available database copies. Now, why three? Well, it goes back to some of that probability theory that I talked about earlier, and go review that on the Exchange Team blog for more details. But you improve or reduce the likelihood of having a failure event for a database by having at least three copies of that particular data when running without RAID. Now, where those three copies are also defines when or where JBOD becomes a possibility in your architecture. For example, if you were to deploy three database copies in a site-resilient fashion, you have two copies in data center one and one copy in data center two, you wouldn't want to deploy that one copy in data center two on JBOD because it's a single point of failure. If you ever lost data center one, you're now operating without any quick recovery action because you only have one copy. And that one copy would be protected by RAID. So you would want to not deploy that one copy on JBOD. You'd want to deploy it on RAID. However, if you move to a four copy architecture, you have two copies in data center one and two copies in data center two, then you have some resilience because overall you have more than three copies. And in the event of loss of the WAN between either two data centers, you still have the ability to have quick recovery in the event of a failure of one copy in either data center. The other aspect I wanted to touch upon is what type of disk should you leverage in the JBOD type of approach. We did, as I mentioned earlier, we did lots of work on the extensible storage engine to reduce our I/O profile in Exchange 2010. That made it that enabled us to leverage 7200 RPM disks. Now, which type of 7200 RPM disk becomes the interesting question. As I mentioned, 7200 RPM disks SATA class typically have an annualized failure rate of 5%. What we've seen from the industry in terms of 7200 RPM SAS drives, serially attached SCSI drives, is that they typically have an annualized failure rate of 2.75%. So they fail less, almost about as half as often as the 7200 RPM SATA variants. So from a perspective of a recommendation of where, of what type of JBOD disk would I push a customer to, it'd probably be the 7200 RPM SAS disk in terms of the reduced annualized failure rate. You also get some additional benefits like about a 20% increase in random I/O capability on the 7200 RPM SAS when compared to the 7200 RPM SATA. The price difference between the two is no more than 5% difference, with the SAS being a little more expensive. But it's the same, you have the same capacity capability of either disk. So it's really about the reduction in it or improvement on the annualized failure rate that makes SAS more interesting for a JBOD type of scenario.
That's great. So, so being the exchange geek that I am, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't dig a little bit more into the type of storage that is typically used for different types of deployments. So, say for example, what is Microsoft using internally versus what are we using in the cloud? I mean, is this something that Microsoft is talking about us using these things? Is this something that Microsoft is just preaching, or is it something that is being just recommended to customers?
Nope. So this is definitely a case where we eat our own dog food. Microsoft IT's corporate deployment is leveraging the 7200 RPM SAS infrastructure in a JBOD capacity with four highly available database copies. And the Office 365 infrastructure, we are also leveraging a JBOD infrastructure with four database copies on 7200 RPM SATA drives. So we definitely eat our own dog food in this case around JBOD deployments. From a customer architectural perspective, it varies from customers. We have many customers who have and this goes back to some of the other paradigm shifts we're trying to enable with Exchange 2010. Large mailboxes is one of our key pillars to enable customers to move data that users frequently want to leverage and historical data that users occasionally access into the mailbox and move away from solutions that involve PSTs or stubbing infrastructures. And getting all that data into a native Exchange environment where a user has full fidelity access to those items, whether it be through OAuth, Outlook, ActiveSync clients, or any other type of client that a user may leverage. And so with that, many customers are moving down the route of the 7200 RPM drives to leverage the large mailboxes. Now, the types of storage infrastructure those customers are leveraging does vary. We have customers deploying Exchange 2010 on storage area networks. We have customers deploying Exchange 2010 on direct attached storage. We have customers deploying these 7200 RPM disks in rated fashion with multiple database copies. We have customers deploying the storage in a JBOD type of approach. So it varies. From a large mailbox perspective, the average tends to be for customers around the 2.5 gig to 5 gig range. There are outliers. We have many customers who are looking at doing much larger mailboxes in terms of implementing the personal archive or online archive and leveraging archive sizes anywhere from 10 gigabytes all the way up to 100 gigabytes. So we have a vast area of where customers choose to manage their Exchange environment from a storage perspective.
That's great. So just to clarify on that, so customers are able to put in multiple different inexpensive storage environments, but they are still able to get larger mailboxes, right? So I said at the beginning, we all have been in that place where, oh, geez, my mailbox is full. So you're saying you have customers today on a regular basis using these lower cost storage platforms, but they're still deploying in large mailboxes in conjunction with them?
Yes, most definitely. Customers are definitely moving toward the lower cost disk offerings that their storage vendors provide them and enabling themselves to deploy large mailboxes.
And are the storage vendors buying into this? Are they happy to essentially say that, look, we've done this with other customers. We've used this storage architecture, with another customer, for their Exchange 2010 deployment?
Yes. There's many different, each storage vendor has many different offerings, and of course the storage vendor does want to work with the customer to determine what the appropriate storage stack should look like in the environment based off the requirements, like the IO requirements, the capacity requirements, the throughput requirements necessary for managing, for deploying that Exchange environment.
Okay, great.
Well, excellent discussion, guys. Talking about Exchange 2010 storage. With me, I have Bob Hunt, Senior IT Pro Evangelist out of New York Metro. Thanks for being here, Bob.
You're very welcome.
And back to Ross. Hey, Ross, where can we get more information about Exchange 2010 storage? Your website, your blog, both?
Yeah, so you can definitely go to the TechNet Library and look at the Exchange 2010 content. We have a whole section on how to design storage for the mailbox server role, the msexchangeteam.com website, which is now hosted on TechNet as well, also provides a vast amount of information around sizing for Exchange 2010. And then there are various tech ed presentations that myself and Matt Gossage and other folks from the product team have delivered that are recordings available that you can go and browse and watch.
Excellent, excellent. Well, with us once again was Bob Hunt. We're going to be doing a series here with various Exchange heavy hitters, if you will, and Ross Smith, a principal program manager with Microsoft, for the member of the customer experience team and Exchange Server product group. It's always a pleasure to have you on IT Time. And with that, guys, it's a wrap.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Thanks.